What would happen if we chose to really tell the truth about ourselves? I'm not saying that it's true. I'm saying that it's my truth.
You're listening to Hammered.
The summer of 2022, it's sort of like it felt freer and I felt lighter and I was starting to kind of come out of that craziness and that fog I had sort of been in. And I could start laughing about a lot of that, the whole Helena Grace, you know, it really became sort of a joke. And Lisa Labolita, you know, when I told her the whole story that night, her and her sister Vicky, aka Debbie, and Gail, you know, they listened very intently, and it really disturbed her. And we were sharing a room that night. They had these two twin beds in the spare bedroom in Gail's new house, and I felt like we were at camp or something. And she said, "You know what?" She said, "Jill, Helena Grease was an entity." She said, "You know, that entity or whatever that was that showed up for you." To mirror you and to show you what you want and not what you don't want. And I said, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. I said, but how crazy is that? Like, you know, I mean, but Lisa's the kind of person that can go down underneath something and see the metaphysical meaning of it. And that's one thing we've always kind of shared. I think that's why we've stayed in touch with each other over all these years, because we kind of identify in life that way. And we don't talk that often anymore, but when we do, we kind of cut to the chase and we get to what's real in both of our lives. And she's grown a lot as a human also over this last 5 years. There's just been a lot of changes, and it makes me happy to see the direction that her life is going in, because I think she's found some things that, you know, get her up in the morning. And that's what's so important, is to have a life that you want to get up in the morning. And that's a big deal for me, because I've had so many times and years in my life where it was like, you know, here we go again kind of thing. And one thing I started to really realize was that, you know, that I'm not broken. I'm just not finished yet. And that started getting real clear to me. And the more that we shed, the more skins and layers that we can shed, you know, really the more clear and more in alignment that I'm going to get. And I also realized that until I'm able to reveal who I really, really am, that I'm never, ever, ever going to have real intimacy. And that was the thing, is like, you know, we talk about intimacy, into me you see, and what the hell is intimacy? Is it giggling with somebody? Is it somebody knowing your real self? Like, what is it? And there's a very fine, fine line of truly being real with somebody and going to that place than just lip service or spiritual bypassing or telling somebody what they want to hear. So, you know, my quest for that summer was to basically do as much as I could do with the time that I had where I'm at, and utilizing, you know, those things that I'm given on each day. Because until I get happy where I'm at, it doesn't matter where I go and who I'm with. if I'm constantly seeking to be somewhere else and to be with someone else, then that's just an illusion, because you don't find it that way. And, you know, I've known that on some intellectual level. I've known that for many, many, many years. But on an unconscious level, I think it's usually in there. But I also started realizing that it's worth, you know, taking a risk rather than staying in the pain that I'm in. You know, do you want to stay in this discomfort or just take a risk and try something different and try to think differently? And, you know, mediocrity, it's a safe place to live. You know, I can hang out in mediocrity all day long and be safe, but still be sort of miserable. And another thing I started kind of contemplating was, you know, how people talk about, like, well, you know, everything in moderation, do everything in moderation. But I started really kind of believing that, you know, everything in moderation is going to keep me fat, depressed, and feeble-minded, you know, and it's kind of like an excuse to, you know, keep getting the comfort from things that aren't good for my brain, you know, sugar, carbs, substances, whatever, alcohol. I don't drink alcohol, but, you know, whatever I could find to kind of give me a lift, or, you know, caffeine even. But it's like, as long as you do it in moderation, then everything's fine. And I think that's really a myth. I think it's an excuse that's sort of like a manipulation to my brain. I mean, that's getting kind of deep, but that's just where I'm at with it. And I have to really, really ask myself every day and boil it down to, is this good for my brain or is this bad for my brain, period? And then, you know, finding new perspectives on how to look at things, you know, having new perspectives will cause, you know, different desires or new desires. And then, you know, new environments can also give you a new perspective. So these were the kind of things that I started working on, you know, in the summer of 2022. And that's why I think sometimes when a disaster happens, it kind of catapults you into either working on these issues of why that upset me so much, why that affected me so much, either work on it or not. And by not, then you stay stuck. It's like you stay in a limbo place of just kind of wondering. And I've just, you know, I know that there's something else going on here. What we see out in our daily life is such an illusion. You know, we live in such a consumer addicted culture. And it's so crazy and insane about, you know, people's looks and implants and butt plants and all the things that people are doing to their, altering themselves to, for what? You know, to take a picture of themselves to say, hey, look at me now. And I mean, I don't know. It's becoming, it's almost sort of comical in a way, but I need to mind my own business and stay in my lane with all of that, because it's really, you know, keep the focus on my own shit and not judge other people and what they're doing. But it's kind of hard to do when everything that you see kind of steers in that direction. So, you know, throughout that summer, it started getting a little bit odd when I got a message from a woman that found me through this dating site, actually the same dating site that Helena Grease, that I had met her, because when I got on that thing, like, they won't eliminate your picture or your profile, I guess, for like a certain time. I kept writing letters and emails saying, take me off of this thing. And I don't think they did, but this person reached out to me, and it was this woman, and said, you know, I know some people in Asheville. I used to live there. And she was an attractive woman, you know, about 50 years old. And it was like, I'd really like to meet you, and la, la, la. And I was like, oh, uh-oh. And, you know, but part of me was like, well, you know, the universe brings people into your life, and just be open. And so the week came and this person came to town and we were going to go have dinner. And so we did, and I found out that she was a facilitator of psilocybin. And I had been, you know, watching all these documentaries on psilocybin and magic mushrooms and all that. And I'd watched this Michael Pollan documentary. And I was very, very open to this because living a life of anxiety, depression, you know, kind of navigating through that for my whole adult life, it's been a real challenge, you know, and I tried antidepressants early on, you know, midway through my 38 years of recovery from alcohol. I had really tried a few different medications because doctors had said, "Ooh, just try this one." And, you know, what I found was that it would, like, you know, within like weeks, it would start to shift and I would change, and then they'd put me on another one. And I said, you know, I just can't, like, this is making me feel worse. It's like making me feel more crazy. So that's why, you know, when all these studies started coming out about psychedelics and things, you know, of course, in the recovery world, it's just like taboo. It's like, no way, Jose, you don't mess with any of that because you've got to be clean and sober and clear. And, you know, but for me, I know that part of my addiction came from being clean and sober and clear. And that sounds like a you know, juxtaposition, but the anxiety, and I don't know if trauma, you know, early trauma, I'm not sure how this whole thing works, but it's kind of like what came first, chicken or the egg. But, you know, the reason I picked up alcohol when I did at such an early age was because now knowing that it was anxiety. There was no label for it back then. There wasn't a name for it, but I know in my heart that that's what it was. And when I would drink alcohol, I could fit in with people and I could laugh and glow and be the life of the party and people loved me. And that whole thing of like, if I could just say what I'm thinking, if I could just say what I'm thinking, because as a child, that's what would go through my mind when I was so locked up inside and so shy. I wanted to talk so bad, but I was just so scared to. Something inside of me would not let me. It's like it had a damn zipper on my mouth. And so, you know, but when I would take a drink, I would just all of a sudden, you know, be this larger than life, happy person, and people loved me and they wanted to be around me. And it was great. And I met some great friends, and things were wonderful until they weren't. And I see that a lot in our culture, you know, and people, they put people on a pedestal until they do something that, you know, is not pleasing. And then they're struck down and then they ridicule them and all that. So, but with this whole new kind of person coming into my world, like very quickly, I was open to learning about this. And I knew that that was the reason that she had landed in Asheville. And I just stayed open. And then she kind of came in my life, left my life, and left me with some doses of this psilocybin. And it was in a chocolate form. And I read and I read and I read about it. And so one Sunday afternoon, I decided, okay, I'm going to try this. I'm going to do this because I cannot continue living in this kind of anxiety. And it just goes on and on and it never ends. And it's something I can't really put it into words, except that I think I've said this before. It's kind of like if you had ants running in your bloodstream that you... It's not even like caffeine. It's more than that. It's like a sort of a low grade panicky feeling that you kind of live with. And if you've never experienced, and then I don't wish that on you, because it's something that I can't, you know, like I said, it's very hard to explain it, but I know that it's been within me for a long time. And it doesn't make for a real good weekend, I tell you that much. And so I decided to do this, and you know, I chose this music. You know, you can find music on YouTube or any place to do this with. And I had this blindfold called a mindfold, and I decided, you know, to lay down and just go for it. And so I ate the dosage, and you know, it took about 45 minutes to an hour for it to start kind of kicking in. And it wasn't like some crazy fucked up trip or anything like that. It was just sort of like kind of like a visual. I kept seeing like playing cards, like kings, queens, aces, you know, like the cards you play with and the characters, kind of like an Alice in Wonderland. And so many different things started flashing, more visual than anything else. But one of the first things that I saw was this little boy, this little white-headed boy standing down on a fence line, and he had on little overalls. And the closer I got, I realized it was at my grandmother's house. And it was my father when he was a little boy, like he was only about 3 or 4. And he was picking up rocks and sticks and throwing them like really mad. And he was kind of crying. And I was almost hovering over him. And all of a sudden I went into him and I became him. And all of a sudden I had this sensation of like the feelings that he was feeling. And I started like crying, tears started rolling down my face. And because the thing about this is like, you're conscious of where you're at, you know what's going on, but you're being an observer. And all of a sudden I realized, you know, hurt people hurt people. And I knew at that moment that that little boy, that father, man, figure in my life had been hurt, and had been hurt so intensely that it was something that I was holding in my own cells. And these are the kind of things, see, that the more and more that I can uncover these mysteries, the freer that I'm going to become. And that's my belief, and that's how I truly believe. I believe that by unlocking these ancestral dysfunctions, that I'm going to have a chance at having a more light, happy, free, simple life, and being happy with the things I have and not constantly wanting to be somewhere else. And, you know, and then that flashed, and I ended up, you know, and then all of a sudden, and this is pretty bizarre, but Helena Grease shows up. Helena Grease, you know, all these pictures that I had gotten from this whoever, I don't know who that person is, but that's the person that kind of showed up as Cleopatra. And I'm like, oh no. So here's Cleopatra and all the ornate makeup and costume. And I'm like, okay. And then it shifts to where I'm looking down and I'm looking at my own legs, and I'm wearing, it looks like those kind of like, you know, medieval kind of sandals. And my legs are actually male, and I'm pulling something, and all of a sudden I hear something like, ksh, ksh, and I'm being hit in the back with a whip. And when I turn around, it's Eva. It's this person I had this infatuation with for about 22 years, and I'm being beaten, and it's another Egyptian. She's sort of like an Egyptian person. And I'm thinking, okay, I don't know what the relation and all of this is, but I'm just watching. And from there, it shifted to Don, my friend Janet's husband, and he was wearing the full Roman or, you know, Greek or Roman gladiator outfit, you know, with the chest plate and the helmet and the sword and the kind of skirt looking thing. And he looked at me with his blue eyes. They sort of twinkle. He's got really pretty eyes, but he looked at me. There was no talking through this whole thing. But what he was saying to me is, I got you. I got you. And I really felt that I had a brother I had a male figure in my life that truly sort of understood me on some level. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do have a connection to him. And then Janet comes out of nowhere, and us three begin to hug one another, and this voice says, "You're connected through the mother wound." And I realized also that they both have issues with their own mothers, and as do I, as we all do. And so that was sort of a bond, and I felt a very deep sense of love for both of them. And I really try not to judge where we're all at, because everybody grows at their own rate. And I just really love them as unconditionally as I can, because they've been there for me through a lot of my, you know, trauma, and they listen a lot of times when they probably just want to say, "Jill, just shut up." You know what I mean? But they've never been that way. They've always been very open to me, and I'm so appreciative to their friendship. So with that, you know, when I came out of that, it went on for a really long time. Like I ate the thing like at 6 o'clock in the evening, and it lasted till about 4:30 a.m. And I had to go to work, and so, but I didn't feel bad. I felt awake. I was just a little bit like, what in the world was all that? You know, because you can read into things, but here's what really happened that showed me that there's something to this. I had to go up to the rock quarry, and it's about 1 hour and 15 minutes from my house, and it was a beautiful sunny day. The sky was blue. I drove up. I got a load of boulders or something, and I was coming back, and I was looking at the sky, and I was looking out my window, and I was listening to some music, and all of a sudden, I realized I don't have anxiety. I took a deep breath, and I was like, I don't have it. I don't have it at all. And it was the first time I had felt like that probably since childhood. And I'm not kidding you. I started crying. Tears started coming down my face. And I'm like, I can't believe this. I don't feel it. I don't feel it in my body. And the whole week, that week, it did not have it in my body. And Friday at 4 o'clock, I felt it come back. It lasted a whole week, and then Friday it came back, and I thought, what triggered it? I don't even remember. I don't even know why it came back, but it came back. And so it sort of showed me that, you know, there is something to this stuff. There's something to these brain patterns and these rut systems, I guess, in our thoughts that can, you know, keep perpetuating the nervous system. I don't really have a scientific understanding. I just, you know, I guess if I really nailed myself to a chair and read things, but it's like I just don't really understand it, but I'm open to it. So, you know, that was one of the things that happened to me during the summer of 2022, and it was like peeling off a whole nother layer, and I felt lighter and freer, and I felt hopeful. I felt like, you know, if I had a week without anxiety, then maybe that's possible. You know, maybe it's possible to have a life without anxiety. And so during this time period, you know, I kept kind of messaging back and forth with this Rosa person, and she was pretty funny, and I like this, you know, the kind of northern New York wit. You know, I'd been with two women in my life. One was from Brooklyn and one was from Long Island, you know, and the coffee talk and the accent and the thing. And I had not heard her voice yet. I had only just read her words. But, you know, I felt like it was going to be a pretty fun trip. And so it was getting close to time to go, and I was going to take Minnie to stay with Janet and Don and then, you know, be on my way. And I was a little bit nervous because I had never gone to Europe before. I'd never traveled, you know, out of the country alone. And I mean, I guess going to Mexico, I went by myself and I made it. It wasn't a big deal or anything. So I knew that I would be okay. And I had a woman named Diane who had helped me schedule my trip, and and, you know, get it together. And I was so grateful to her and appreciative to her because, you know, I tried to do it on my own. And once I started seeing all these different legs and timing and all that, so, but she got it all fixed for me and I was ready to go. And I got to the airport and then, began the journey, you know, from Asheville to Newark and then Newark to Athens. And then once I got to Athens, I took a small flight to Crete. And so I was going to fly into Crete and then someone was to pick me up and take me to Chania, which is spelled Chania. And that's where I was going to meet this group. Now, at the airport in Crete, there was a driver waiting, and I found him, and he says, well, we got to wait for the other people. And so that's when I met the other cast of characters that were going to be on this trip. And they were all, you know, we all kind of said hello to each other, and they all knew each other, and they were Jersey girls, and they were pretty funny. And we got in the van and start the drive on Chania, and it was pretty curvy wervy, and I didn't feel that great because of jet lag and, you know, a little bit of nausea and stuff. But I was just listening to them and listening to them talk, and I didn't say a whole lot. And we began the journey to go to Chania. I think it was Georgiopolis or somewhere. It was a smaller little place and where we were going to be staying. And we got there and I was a little bit nervous because I was going to meet Rosa and the other host, Maria, for the first time. And I had, you know, communicated with them back and forth. So I was looking forward to meeting them. And I got out of the van and they were getting my stuff and everything. And I saw Rosa and, you know, she laughed and said, give me a hug. And so I went over and I hugged her and Maria, and I was really happy to see everybody. And we went into the lobby and we're standing there, and this blonde lady walks in and she kind of drops her suitcase and looks at me and says, you're Jill Haney. And I started laughing and I said, yeah. And it was so weird because she had been listening to my podcast and then was actually rooming next door to me. Her name was Star. And she was from West Palm Beach, I think, in Florida. And she was one of the straight women. There were two straight women and everybody else was gay. So this was going to be an interesting, you know, group of people. And so we hit it off and she roomed next door to me. And then we were going to be in, I guess, this little Georgiopolis place for several days. And it was just... I was excited, you know, and then that night we were going to have a dinner. Once we all kind of got settled in and everything, I went in my room and unpacked and, you know, you kind of get ready to, I guess we were all going to meet at dinner and kind of, you know, I guess get to know each other, what have you. And so we had the dinner and I was sitting by Maria and she's Greek. And so she was really funny, lives in New Jersey. But, you know, I was just sort of trying to feel out like, who are these people? And I couldn't tell if they were being serious or if they were being funny. There was another girl named Stephanie and she was young. I thought she was like in her 20s, but she was actually 44, I think, or 42, but she just looked so young. And she had had breast cancer and had been a breast cancer survivor and was still doing treatments. And so she kind of opted to sort of just do what she could do and not participate full-fledged in the whole trip because she was still having some issues and stuff. The place, you know, it was very quaint. And what I could tell so far, it was a kind of an old world feel. It was on the water. It was on the Mediterranean. It was beautiful. And that dinner, you know, that night, they had a little bag of rocks and they were going to pass this little bag around and they wanted you to pick a rock and you'd get to keep it. And when I chose the little, it was like a polished river stone, and I pulled the stone out and it had the word love on it. And I was like, oh, good, I gotta love rock, you know. And it kind of made me laugh because inside I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, if these women only knew my history. And, you know, Rosa had started listening to my podcast, and so she kind of, I think, had an idea about who I was, but not really. It's hard to get a real true read on somebody until you meet them in person. And so, but that night was an interesting meal because the server was kind of getting upset, and I guess it was just the whole New York vibe was coming out, and everybody was very, you know, kind of loud and demanding, and it's just kind of how they roll. And I was just sort of listening, and I thought it was really funny. I felt like I was in a Seinfeld episode, and so I thought, man, this is going to be a very funny, interesting trip. And so that night, you know, everybody goes to sleep, and the next morning, Rosa and I had decided to go walk. She walked a lot. She had been texting me or sending me some videos of places that she walks on the Jersey Shore that were very pretty. And I always had a perception or an idea of Jersey Shore being like dirty and hypodermic needles and stuff, because that's the things we would see on TV growing up about the North, were how, you know, gross and nasty the beaches were. And it's so funny because, you know, I'm sure that Northern people get, you know, they get to see the deliverance part of the South. They don't see the beauty and the elegance and the class that the South can have, just like, you know, we see the burned out, boarded up buildings of the Bronx and, you know, the beaches being gross and stuff like that. So it was kind of funny, but she was a walker, and I'm like, well, let's walk, you know. And I was not going to be doing my rowing and my morning routine, so I knew I was going to have to do something physical. So we took this walk, and it was so interesting because it was like, it was kind of like a real comfort to be around her. I didn't have like any huge fireworky weird feeling, thank God, but it just felt very comfortable. And so we walked, and we passed all these, you know, some vineyards and some old ruins of structures. You'd see like a random cafe or pub, and then you know, so, and just talking, and there would be like goats and chickens. And this is my very first time to Europe, so anytime I see like a stone, you know, ruin or something like that, I'm just totally looking at it like, oh, look at that. I wonder how old that is. And I'm sure she's thinking like, Jesus, what's up with the rock thing? But, you know, it was all around me, and so I was super intrigued with that. And then that afternoon, I decided to go down to the beach by myself, and I went down, and the beach was really pebbly, like rocks, and I loved it. It was just, I mean, it wasn't great to walk on, but it was so, I wanted to just get them all and take them with me, you know. They were just beautiful little pebbles and stones, and I got in the water, you know, and I'm thinking in my mind, like, I'm in the Mediterranean. Like, I've never been in the Mediterranean. Like, this is weird, and it was just dark and deep, dark navy blue almost, and it was just very cool and refreshing and felt great. And I got out, and I was laying in a chair, and I could listen to all these different languages around me. And the people, you know, everybody seemed to be very free in their body. It wasn't this pretentious, kind of like if you're on a beach in, say, Destin, Florida or somewhere, or Fort Lauderdale. You know, if you're somewhere like that on a beach, then you're kind of like, oh, God, let me suck my stomach in 400 miles and let me hide myself and let me, you know. But this was not the case. This was like all walks of life, all different, you know, cultures coming together on this one beach, and nobody was really looking at other people. It wasn't, you know, like nobody was staring and summing people up or sizing them up by their bathing suit or anything like that. So that was a really nice, comfortable place to be. And I just laid in that sun, and I just soaked it all up, and I was just really, really thanking the universe or God or Helena Grease, you know, because really and truly, Helena Grease was what got me there. I'm like, I'm in Greece. I'm on the island of Crete. Why? I don't know. But I do know that that entity, that situation is what, you know, caused me to take this step. And, you know, you look at things that happen in your life and you think, oh, that's so bad. That's such a horrible thing that happened, blah, blah, blah. But is it? Maybe it was one of the best things that's ever happened in my whole entire life. I don't know. But, you know, we began the journey. We were going to take a tour with this guy named Michael. And it's Nicholas something is his true name, but he goes by Michael. And what a sweet man, you know. And so we took the van, and I learned I'd better start eating some Dramamine because these were some curvy, wervy, mountainous roads. And fortunately, Maria had some that were the non-drowsy formula, thank goodness, because the other type just kind of knock you out. But we stopped at this cemetery on the way to a monastery, and I noticed the stone pebbles used in joints of these, you know, stone pavers, floors, or patio surfaces, whatever you want to call it. But I remember thinking in my mind, I'm going to do that when I go home. You know, I was getting such inspiration, but with some of the stone work and some of the artistic things that they had done in ancient Greece, I mean, these were some old, old, old structures. I was wearing my Magnolia Pearl pants that Janet had turned me on to, taught me into. They were these kind of orange and green plaid pants and an off-white t-shirt because it was pretty hot. And we get to this monastery, and it was just gorgeous. It was just beautiful. And ironically, the coloring matched my pants. It was sort of this orangey, kind of stucco-y. And it was funny because I really kind of matched. But there was tons of stonework, no pun intended. The plants and the trees were just super healthy, and everything was really maintained. It was very peaceful. And I kept seeing these stone rectangle patterns on the ground, you know, on the floor, like just everywhere. It was like cut rectangles. And it was so crazy because when I returned, when I was supposed to return back to the States, I was going to be doing a job that consisted of four patios that the people wanted rectangular cut stones used in a very contemporary fashion. Well, this wasn't contemporary. This was like 3,000 and 4,000 years old. And so I was intrigued with that. And I thought, well, I'm getting to see this up close and personal. And that really made me happy because I was sort of getting a tutorial on how this looked and how they placed the stones and how they lined up the joints and everything. So I was getting sort of a free lesson to look at this stuff. And so then, you know, we traveled. I remember we traveled to Old Town Hanya, which is a very, very sweet town. I immediately fell in love there. There were a lot of scooters and mopeds and motorcycles kind of lining the streets, you know, of the outdoor cafes. There were kids playing in the streets and people outside socializing, and the smells and the aromas of the cafes and the apartments, people cooking. It was approaching dinner time when we got there. And, you know, if it wasn't for the air conditioner units, you know, in view, you would think that you'd step back in time into a much earlier era. But, you know, that kind of gave it away that it was a modern time. But, you know, just looking down the streets and seeing clothes hanging on the clotheslines from balcony to balcony. And, you know, there were shops and vendors underneath these apartments, and there were craftspeople. I started noticing the evil eye, which is the round, looks like an eyeball, and it's basically to keep evil away. And they sell a lot of jewelry with that, and a lot of shirts with that, and bags. And it's kind of a symbol you see everywhere in Greece. And I didn't really know what it was, and I kind of started learning about that. But the town of Hanya, Old Town, it sort of had a Victorian feel, and it was very colorful and vibrant, but it was subdued to a degree, so it didn't get on your nerves, you know, and it wasn't trying to be something. It was a town that wasn't trying to be something. It was something. It was extraordinary. And I could feel it. It evoked a feeling in me, and I thought, you know, I think I could live here. And I know that I probably say that a lot when I go places, but I really felt it on some level. And then the sun started going down, and it started to get pretty crowded, and I realized that everybody was going to go down to see the sunset over the water. And there was this 16th century lighthouse that jetted out, sort of like an arm, you know, like a jetty or something. And it was modest and sort of a petite lighthouse, but it had a presence about it. You know, it was, I guess, there was a lot of Venetian and Egyptian influence in that town. And the streets were kind of lined with wrought iron gas lanterns, and it was along this inlet, and I kept seeing those stone rectangle stone pavers everywhere. It was just beautiful. And I mean, like probably over a mile of those stone pavers, and they were gray, just like the Jamestown flagstone that I was going to be using on my next job. So that was really intriguing to me, and there were boats in the harbor. I passed an old jail, and I saw this old jail window with bars in it, and you know, the age of all this was just blowing my mind. And you know, we were actually looking for a restaurant. We had a reservation, and the sun, like I said, was going down. It was orange and pink and blue, and it was gorgeous. And there were cafes all around. There was these cafes that were in these really old structures with elegant white tablecloths, and there was one that had like all these blue ladder back chairs, like hundreds, and it reminded me of my 60 red ladder back chairs from the Enchanted Garden Cafe and the ones that Red Devil stole. And I guess she had to steal them because they were red. I don't know. That's a whole nother thing and a whole nother life that I just can't go there anymore. But dinner, I just remember I was pretty quiet, and I was just listening and paying really close attention to what I was hearing. And once again, I kind of felt like I was in a Seinfeld episode. Dinner was really good, and I was a little nervous because that's just what seems to happen. But I was entertained by the accents and the loudness. I couldn't really hear that well because it seemed like everyone knew each other, and they would finish each other's sentences, or a topic would start and five people would yell the punchline or the event. And it was like a tennis match, and I felt like a low talker, like on Seinfeld. I remember there was an episode with a low talker, and if somebody asked me a question, I would start to say it, but I couldn't even hear myself. But then we left there, and we were going to walk around some more. And I remember walking by this man, and he was selling, you know, sponges from the ocean, and he really, really looked like a Greek sailor or a Greek Navy man. He was really handsome, and he had like a weathered complexion and this navy blue cap, kind of like a sailor's hat, captain's hat, and he had a kind of a gap between his teeth, salt and pepper hair. And you know, mustache, salt and pepper mustache. He was just really totally like a man of the sea. And I smiled, and he smiled, and I kept walking, and I thought, you know, isn't it funny how a weathered complexion looks handsome on a man? And I wonder, you know, where the first notion that it was unattractive on women came from, that, you know, being weathered is unattractive on a woman. I thought, when did it start? Like maybe the cave women? Who knows? I mean, it's ingrained deeply, even in some of our faces. It's so interesting to me what we see in our world and our culture as beauty or non-beauty. And I just knew that I was in the right place. And we returned to Old Town after a big excursion. And that night, Rosa and I decided to go walking. And it was actually the night of a blood moon. And I'd kind of been keeping up with this thing, hearing about it and reading about it. And so we go walking down by the water, and there was this small little white chapel that was out on a jetty or out on this little island all by itself. And it had a light shining on it, and it was really beautiful. And you could hear the water and the waves, and you could see the white caps sort of, you know, splashing. And we kind of kept walking, and we ran into a few of the other women from the group and just kind of said, hey. And then I look, and the blood moon was really red. Like, it had some tints of orange, but I mean, it was really red. I had never, ever seen a moon like that in my life. It was almost sort of scary. And it was over the Mediterranean Sea. And I stood there and I was seeing a blood red moon over the Mediterranean Sea. I was looking at a blood red moon over the Mediterranean Sea.
Hammered is recorded and produced in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Asheville, North Carolina. It's narrated by Jill Haney, produced by Jill Haney, and with sound design, editing, and music by Alexander Rodriguez. Our beautiful artwork was created by Lauren Caddick, and we'd like to send a special thanks out there to Minnie and Robin. You can check out our website, podcasthammered.com, and follow us on social media for updates.